Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 2.28, Armenian Fire, Albanian Revolt. Astride the Sehan River, whose sparkling water meanders through the Cilician Plain and into the eastern Mediterranean, sits the city of Adana, that beating heart of southern Anatolia. Cilicia is an ancient region whose great agricultural wealth had attracted human settlers for many thousands of years. But in recent decades, the industrial production of cotton had exploded and brought great prosperity to Adana and the surrounding countryside. Unlike its sister cities on the Ottoman Mediterranean, Izmir and Salonika, which had a fairly diverse industrial base, Adana's economy was almost exclusively centered around textile production and cotton ginning. This burgeoning economy had drawn many migrant workers to Adana in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and following that great catastrophe of the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78, when Ottoman Muslims had been driven out of their ancestral European homes in the hundreds of thousands. An increasing number of these workers flooding into Adana were Muslim refugees coming from Europe, known as the Muhajir, or often generalized as Circassians. Working alongside these Muslim day laborers were often Armenians, who long made up a very significant portion of the population in Adana. And generally speaking, Adana was a city roughly split down the middle between Christian Armenians and Muslims, mostly Turks, Kurds, and Muhajirs. And then there was also the typical Ottoman smattering of Greeks, Jews, Syriacs, Arabs, and others. The Armenian community in Adana had been one of the few to escape the horrific carnage of the Hamidian massacres of 1894-96. And so, unlike other cities of Anatolia, such as Van and Erzurum, where the Armenian population had been decimated politically, socially, and economically, the Armenians of Adana had continued to more or less thrive. Historically, Armenians had played a critical role in the Ottoman economy as merchants and traders. So, when Adana became a cotton boom town, a thriving middle class developed amongst the Armenian community of Adana, as Armenians naturally prospered as owners of cotton gins, workshops, and trading houses. Then, following the July 1908 revolution, when the CUP kicked down the door of Hamidian despotism, and liberal reforms were ushered in, allowing for the creation of political parties and the free publication of newspapers, magazines, and journals, the Armenian community of Adana was again well-positioned to take on a more prominent role within the newly liberal environment. And so, as we have talked about, one of the primary effects of the Young Turk Revolution was that certain groups, such as ethnic minorities and women, became newly visible within the public sphere. And this began to seriously offend conservative Muslims who were loyal to the Sultan and who were pious followers of traditional Sharia Islamic law. Resentment felt amongst conservative Muslims following the revolution of 1908. Became especially pronounced in the city of Adana, with its bulging population of poor Muslim workers who had experienced an insane amount of generational trauma. Many Muhajir refugees had been forced from their ancestral homes in Europe starting in 1878, usually being expelled from their homes by a murderous and vengeful army of Russians, Serbians, or Bulgarians. So, as we talked about during our series on the Armenian resistance, many Muhajir refugees felt an acute sense of paranoia, fear, and resentment towards Christians in general. Then, following the Hamidian massacres, Sultan Abdulhamid's government had inaugurated a program of resettlement for many Muslim migrants. However, almost as a rule, these Muslims would displace Christians living in Anatolia, and since a great number of Christians in Anatolia were Armenians, this influx of Muhajir refugees was especially damaging for the Armenian community. As we touched upon, one angle in which to understand the Hamidian massacres of the mid-1890s is as simply the most dramatic and violent articulation of a more general process in which European Muslims displaced Christian Armenians and Assyrians throughout Anatolia. So, this is all to say that it would be quite the understatement to say that moving into the 20th century, there was a whole lot of tension between the Muhajir refugees and the Armenians living in Anatolia. Then, following the July 1908 revolution, not only the Armenians of Adana took advantage of the newly liberal environment, and local religious leaders, mostly Muslim imams, also began publishing in newspapers, journals, and pamphlets. Within these conservative papers, reactionary Muslim writers began to accuse Armenians of arming themselves, plotting rebellion, and even planning to drive out all Muslims in order to establish a fanciful Kingdom of Armenia. Now, we can go ahead and cordon off nearly all of this talk of revolutionaries establishing an Armenian kingdom as pretty much entirely based in paranoid conspiracy theories. Because following the 1908 revolution, Armenians had not begun to arm themselves, but instead had sort of done the opposite. Just as had happened in Macedonia, where Bulgarian, Greek, and Albanian guerrillas had come down from the mountains to ceremoniously turn in their weapons and declare their allegiance to the new constitutional regime, so too the Armenian guerrillas in Anatolia, who were typically part of the Dashnak Armenian Revolutionary Federation, had also come down from the mountains and turned in their weapons. The Armenian Dashnaks had become a legalized party in 1908, so Dashnak leaders had ordered their guerrilla bands to disarm and to declare their loyalty to the constitution. Most Dashnaks obeyed this command, even if they did so reluctantly. So, following July 1908, Armenian revolutionaries had, for the most part, disarmed themselves, and many planned to turn away from revolutionary politics in order to embrace parliamentary politics. But Armenians, and Christians more generally, did become more visibly active in Ottoman politics following the revolution, and this visibility offended reactionary Muslims. So, just as it happened in Istanbul, where the inflammatory Dervish Vahdetti had stirred up resentment amongst pious Muslims, religious leaders and imams in Adana similarly played upon the fears felt amongst Muslims that their traditional place in society was threatened by the new constitutional order. And so, as these inflammatory rumors and conspiracies were being spread, many leaders in Adana began to feel that the city was one crisis away from chaos and mass violence. This crisis would come in spring 1909, when reactionary soldiers and pious religious students rose up in Istanbul and occupied the imperial capital. On April the 14th, just one day after the reactionary mob took over Istanbul during the 31 March incident, a street clash would break out between Muslims and Armenians in Adana. This clash escalated very, very quickly, and suddenly mosques throughout the city, many of which were led by reactionary imams, began declaring jihad, and Muslim mobs began attacking Armenian businesses, killing their owners, and looting their stores. This violence then began to spread over the next 2 days, largely due to the inaction of the Ottoman governor of Adana, who failed to act decisively, with many suspecting then and now that this inaction was due to the fact that the governor sympathized with the reactionary mob. Over the next 2 days, the Armenian quarter of Adana would be attacked by a mob, who began burning and looting buildings and homes. And then these massacres would spread to the surrounding towns and villages. Large fires would engulf Armenian neighborhoods, and defenseless Armenian civilians would take refuge in foreign missionaries and schools. And throughout the massacres, many foreign nationals, teachers, missionaries, and consuls would step up and selflessly defend the lives of defenseless Armenians. Amidst this violent chaos, some Armenians would feel that they had no choice but to fight back against the mob in self-defense. And these self-defense committees would often be led by Dashnak revolutionaries. This first round of massacres would finally abate after around 2 to 3 days. And in the end, hundreds of Armenians lay dead, and dozens of churches and Armenian businesses lay in ashes. Then, for about a week, Adana remained in a state of tense anticipation, as no one knew how the events in Istanbul were going to play out, and whether Hamidian autocracy was going to be reinstated, or whether the CUP was going to save the constitution. And well, as we know from the last episode, the Action Army under Mahmud Shevket would arrive in Istanbul on April the 24th, and they would quickly defeat the counter-revolutionaries. They would place Istanbul under martial law and then reestablish the constitutional order by force. During the week in between the first outbreak of violence in Adana and the occupation of Istanbul by the Action Army, conservative voices in the news had spread more conspiracy theories amongst Muslim workers, the most common and pernicious being that the recent violence in the city had not been caused by reactionary Muslims, but instead had been instigated by the Armenians themselves. And the idea even began to gain serious traction that the Armenians had burned down their own churches and buildings in order to bring on a foreign intervention that would help revolutionaries establish their fanciful Armenian kingdom. Which, as insane conspiratorial ideas go, this one is pretty insane and conspiratorial. But this is all to say that Adana had been sitting on a knife's edge for a week. And so, when the news of the occupation of Istanbul by forces loyal to the constitutional regime reached the city, it would spark off another wave of violence in Adana. And this second wave would be much more terrible. Because during the second wave of violence, it would not simply be angry Muslim workers led by reactionary religious leaders, but also Ottoman soldiers and Muslim irregulars, who could be seen not only arming the mob, but also actively participating in the massacres. This violence would spread throughout the entire region of Cilicia, as Armenian communities in the surrounding towns and villages also fell victim to the reactionary mobs who rampaged through the streets, indiscriminately killing unarmed civilians and burning whole communities to the ground. In the end, it is estimated that some 20 to 30,000 Armenians would be killed during the Adana massacres, marking by far the worst interethnic violence since the Hamidian massacres. Unlike the Hamidian massacres of the mid-1890s, the Adana massacre was not an orchestrated event driven by policies emanating from the highest levels of government. In Ronald Grigor Suni's book, They Can Live in the Desert But Nowhere Else, which is one of the most comprehensive resources on the Armenian genocide that I have found, Suni describes the Adana massacre as, quote, more like an urban riot that degenerated into a pogrom rather than a state-initiated mass killing. And so, after order was restored in Istanbul, the new government under the leadership of Mahmud Shevket and the CUP sent an official delegation to investigate the atrocities committed against Armenians in Adana. The Adana massacre had shocked the empire and the international community, and the CUP felt that they had to do everything they could to show that the constitutional order would bring justice to those standing in the way of imperial unity and domestic peace. So, the CUP would elect none other than Ahmed Cemal to head this investigative committee sent to Adana. Now, we've mentioned Ahmed Cemal a bunch of times at this point, as he had been a prominent revolutionary officer in the Third Army leading up to the revolution. He was an early member of the Ottoman Freedom Society, and he played a very active role in the actual mutiny of July 1908. Then, most recently, Cemal had served as the chief of staff for General Mahmud Shevket during the assault and occupation of Istanbul by the Action Army. So, Cemal had emerged as a powerful unionist officer, holding a position within the CUP's Sacred Committee and enjoying a high rank within the Ottoman Army. And so, the choice of Cemal to head the Adana Commission demonstrates the seriousness with which the new government was treating the tragic events in Adana. Upon his arrival in Adana, Jamal began investigating the causes of the massacres, identifying the primary perpetrators of the violence, and generally assessing the blame of local officials and religious leaders. Jamal's final report on the massacres would lead to the arrest of several reactionary Islamic clerics and other local agitators who would be tried and executed. The governor of Adana was also dismissed, and he was replaced by none other than Ahmed Jamal himself, who would serve as governor of the Adana province for the next 2 years. Of those executed for their instigation of the violence, there would be around 20 Muslims, mostly Islamist clerics, but also some soldiers and civilian agitators, as well as around 5 Armenians, mostly Dashnaks who had led the self-defense groups during the massacres. Now, this might seem odd that Armenians would be executed for this massacre. But what you have to remember is that due to the peddling in conspiracy theories, many at the time, and a surprising amount of people today, believed that the Armenian revolutionaries had been the initial instigators of the violence. But as we have seen, this just did not square with reality, and those who had fought back against the Muslim mob usually did so in self-defense, and they would later argue that they were in fact fighting to protect the constitutional regime, which was most likely true. So, most historians explain these conspiracies about Armenians instigating the violence as essentially propaganda, meant to cover up complicity amongst local leaders. But these conspiracies were so widely believed that Jamal and other CUP leaders likely felt that they had to arrest and execute a handful of Armenian revolutionaries in order to appease the reactionary mobs of Adana. But with that said, Jamal was generally viewed at this time as a progressive force, and it would not be until later, during World War I, that he would gain his reputation as an authoritarian ruler. So, during his 2-year stint as governor of Adana, Jamal helped to rebuild the infrastructure of the region, provided humanitarian support for Armenian victims, and clamped down on religious reactionaries and unruly tribal forces. So, following the Adana massacre, the Armenian community would, very hesitatingly, embrace the return of constitutional rule under the CUP. And even after this violence, the Armenian Dashnaks would continue to work alongside the CUP, and they would recommit themselves to preserving, quote, the Ottoman fatherland from separation and division. And in a case of terribly tragic irony, the Dashnaks and many Armenians more generally would view the recent rise to power of CUP leader Mehmet Talat, now Minister of the Interior and future architect of the genocide, as a generally positive development in 1909, due to Mehmet Talat's historic role as a key point of contact between the Dashnaks and the CUP. Now, things were definitely not all sunshine and daisies between the CUP and the Armenian community, and the Adana massacres had badly shaken the confidence of Armenians in the ability of the Young Turks to protect them from arbitrary violence. And then, even though the CUP took many official measures to ensure justice for the victims in Adana, the written responses of individual CUP members were much more muddled and confusing. And this was largely because unionists tended to see both reactionary Muslims and Armenians as just like generally troublesome and harmful to Ottoman unity, which they were obsessed with. The reaction of the sociologist and future father of Turkish nationalism, Ziya Gökalp, is especially revealing. Gökalp would pen an article following the massacre in which he would place the blame for the massacres solely on reactionaries, and he would attribute the killings entirely to religious fanaticism and to the ignorance of the Muslim masses. Meaning that Gökalp would place no blame whatsoever on the state institutions, which had failed to prevent the massacres from happening in the first place. Gerkalp would also frame the massacres as essentially a backlash against modernity and progress. And he would use the tragic events to argue that the only way forward was to aggressively secularize and centralize the empire in order to build a more unified state in which civic participation was more important than religious or ethnic ties. In short, Gerkalp used the Adana massacres as basically a PR moment to promote centralization and Ottoman unity, insisting that the empire desperately needed a new national identity based on shared citizenship and modern values. Within Gerkalp's framing of the Adana massacres lay the seeds of both Turkish nationalism and the future exclusion of Armenians from Turkish nationalism. Because in his article, Gerkalp did not mourn the loss of Armenian lives, but instead the loss of Ottoman unity. This obsession with national unity speaks to the rising importance of a new group of unionists who were becoming increasingly prominent within the CUP's Sacred Committee, and who were just beginning to articulate a new ideology: Turkism. Ziya Gerkalp would become the prophet or spirit of this group, and tellingly, it was in late 1909 that Talat would first become friends with Ziya Gerkalp. Eventually, Gerkalp would become Talat's closest friend, and in the coming years, Gerkalp would provide CUP leaders with a much-needed ideological program. As one Turkish historian would later put it, quote, Talat Pasha and Enver Pasha adored Ziya Gerkalp like a holy man. They took every word from him as wonderful wisdom. In every topic, his scientific opinions made him predominant in the Central Committee. Arguably, Ziya Gerkalp would be the single most influential Turkish intellectual of the first half of the 20th century, and it was in late 1909, following the counter-revolution and the Adana massacre, that his influence within the CUP would begin to rise. The personal transformation of Ziya Gerkalp and his growing influence over CUP leaders such as Talat and Enver illuminates a broader transformation of the Unionist faction who would come to dominate the Ottoman government by 1913. Ziya Gerkalp grew up in Diyarbakir, a city in eastern Anatolia, home to that explosive mix of Kurds, Turks, and Armenians that was always on the verge of breaking out into interethnic violence. So, Gerkalp witnessed the Hamidian massacres firsthand, and he shared many of the resentments felt amongst Muslims towards Christians. Ziya Gerkalp grew up within a pious Muslim family. However, he always held a constant thirst for discovering what he called the, quote, supreme truth, that at times bordered on the manic. And when Gerkalp was a teenager, he was introduced to biological materialism and other ideas that challenged his traditional religious worldview. And this distressed the adolescent Gerkalp to such an extent that he tried to shoot himself in the head, but he survived. After nearly dying by suicide, Gerkalp would be swooped up by none other than our old friend, Abdullah Cevdet, one of the first founders of the CUP. Cevdet largely rescued Gerkalp from his depressive state and gave his life purpose when he inaugurated the young man into the revolutionary and conspiratorial circles of the CUP. Then, like most young Turks, Gerkalp would fully embrace Ottomanism and multicultural unity following the July 1908 revolution, and Gerkalp founded a CUP branch in Diyarbakir. But then, in September 1909, following the counter-revolution and the Adana massacre, Gerkalp moved to Salonika, and it was during this time that he and Talat would become best friends, whose favorite activity was engaging in long, drawn-out political discussions. Through his friendship with Talat, Gerkalp would begin to influence the Sacred Committee of the CUP, and Gerkalp's time spent amongst the patriotic Muslims of Salonika would also begin to radically alter his worldview. and it would be while living in Salonika that Zia would take on the name Gergalp, which means something like celestial hero, as Gergalp essentially transformed himself into like a mad prophet who predicted the coming greatness of the Turkish people. I have often seen this worldview described as, quote, messianic Turkism or Turanism. Essentially, Gergalp began to promote the idea of a great awakening amongst the Turkish people, and he would begin to argue that the Turkish race was exceptional and that Ottoman Turks had a destiny to unite all Turkic peoples of the world. Now, if this all sounds somewhat familiar, that's because this sort of expansionist and messianic nationalism is honestly very similar to the radical irredentist nationalism that had come to dominate politics in places like Bulgaria, Serbia, and Greece. This is sort of like the Turkish version of that. And so, as Bulgarians, Serbs, Greeks, and other Christian Europeans denounced Muslim Turks as backwards and barbarous, Gergalp would spin this idea completely on its head and argue that Islam was in fact the most modern religion, and that Turks were a uniquely modern race. Gergalp would eventually describe Turks as the supermen imagined by Nietzsche. Now, what is most symbolic here is that Gergalp's ideological transformation around 1909 can be boiled down to a transition from Ottomanism to Turkism. And at the heart of this transformation was a manic obsession with social cohesion and national unity. Gergalp was very influenced by the French sociologist Emile Durkheim. And without wanting to get too much into the weeds here, Durkheim was a firm believer in the idea that the social group took precedence over the individual. And Gergalp would follow Durkheim in this belief. And in one of Gergalp's poems called Duty, Gergalp states, quote, "I do not have rights, interests, and desires. I have my duty and do not need anything else. I close my eyes, I perform my duty." So, going into 1910, the Sacred Committee of the CUP was moving in a decisively Turkish nationalist direction, as achieving unity through Ottomanism was increasingly seen as unrealistic, with more and more unionists coming to believe that the only way to achieve the unity they so desired was through promoting Islam and Turkish national identity and language amongst the masses. This emergent project would eventually come to be dubbed, usually by its detractors, as Turkification. And as you can probably guess, Turkification is going to make non-Turkish speaking Ottomans really super duper mad and would almost immediately lead to outright revolt. However, it would not be amongst Armenian communities that the first sparks of revolt would be lit, because, as we have said, Armenians were largely forced to work with the CUP as like the least worst option amongst terrible options. Instead, the initial revolts against CUP centralization and Turkification would break out all the way across the empire in Kosovo, where Albanians were beginning to rise up against CUP rule. As we mentioned last week, the occupation of Istanbul by the Action Army in April 1909 represented the true arrival of militarism to Ottoman politics, as both General Mahmud Shevket and the CUP would now look to the army as a vaunted institution. The young Mektebli officers who gained prominence following both the July 1908 revolution and the 1909 Action Army assault on Istanbul came to see themselves as the true defenders of the Constitution and as above civilian politics. And then on top of this, most of these elite officers were either members of the CUP or at the very least shared the unionist obsession with social cohesion and national unity. What this obsession with unity meant in practice was clamping down on unruly elements out in the provinces. And this is essentially the same dynamic we talked about during our discussion of the earlier Tanzimat reforms, in which imperial elites attempted to impose an Ottomanist identity onto the insanely diverse population of their empire. And well, the Young Turks were Ottomanists who looked towards Tanzimat reformers like Midhat Pasha as their heroes. So the new CUP government would push ahead with that very difficult task of reining in the unruly provinces. But now that the military had gained new prominence, this task would no longer be led by imperial bureaucrats, but by army officers. The appointment of Ahmed Jamal as governor of Adana was a prime example of this phenomenon, in which young Mektebli officers with very little real experience in administration and very little real knowledge of local politics were appointed as governors or inspectors, and then were expected to modernize their provinces mainly through lessening the power of local leaders and increasing the power of the imperial center in Istanbul. In practice, this often meant curtailing the many privileges that Sultan Abdul Hamid had bestowed upon local power brokers. Because, say what you will about Abdul Hamid, he was a dang good politician. And Abdul Hamid knew that you can't just ignore the desires of local leaders. You have to cultivate their loyalty through offering perks and privileges and letting people do their own thing. And when necessary, letting people skim off the top. Mahmud Shevket and the CUP would run into a whole lot of roadblocks as they attempted to centralize and modernize the peripheral territories of the empire. But the Albanians would become the most troublesome population for the new government. As we have mentioned, Albanians had played a major role in all of the great revolutionary moments we have so far discussed, as Albanians had dominated the mutinous armies during the July 1908 revolution, and they had dominated the Action Army under Mahmud Shevket. And in some ways, the Young Turk Revolution was, ironically enough, largely an Albanian movement, or at the very least, the revolution represented the alliance of young Turkish officers from the Balkans with their Albanian brothers, who all wanted to bring European-style modernity and national unity to the empire. Throughout 1908, 1909, and into 1910, Albanian and Turkish leaders would all more or less continue to publicly declare their commitment to the overall project of Ottomanism, in which Albanians and Turks were supposed to be equal citizens. However, privately, both Turks and Albanians began to express increasingly nationalist sentiments. For the Turks, this is everything we just talked about, as the Sacred Committee of the CUP came under the sway of new radical voices, such as Ziya Gurkalp, who were pushing Turkish nationalism. And well, the same thing was more or less happening amongst Albanian leaders, who would publicly pronounce their commitment to Ottoman unity while privately pushing an Albanian nationalist agenda. And then outside of these inner circles of power, local Albanian leaders would not so privately resist the arrival of CUP-style militarized centralization. This resistance would come in a few different forms. To begin with, the initial liberalization directly following the revolution led to a veritable renaissance in Albanian culture, as dozens of Albanian cultural clubs were formed, and then just as many political clubs formed as well, who would lobby their Albanian constituents for increased rights, privileges, and autonomy, just as the CUP was specifically trying to curtail special rights, privileges, and autonomy in the name of national unity. One of the most divisive issues on the cultural front centered around the formalization of the Albanian language. A large movement would develop in which local leaders pushed for the use of the Latin alphabet for the Albanian language. However, Imperial Ottoman Turkish, which was the language the hardcore unionists hoped everyone would adopt one day, used the Arabic script. The controversy over the Albanian alphabet immediately put the Young Turks in an awkward position, where they, on the one hand, promised liberal reforms and increased rights, while on the other hand, they had as a crucial element within the overall project of building a unified Ottoman identity, getting everyone to adopt the Turkish language. And this gets to the heart of the contradictions inherent within Ottomanism. Namely that Ottomanists openly supported pluralism and cosmopolitanism, while many Ottomanist Turks, especially those within the Sacred Committee, viewed themselves as naturally the dominant imperial group. We love diversity, but also everyone needs to speak Turkish in the name of national unity. The debate over language demonstrates how Ottomanism gradually began to morph into Turkification once the CUP was actually in power. And then, on top of these public debates around Albanian culture and language, outright revolts would also begin to break out in the Albanian provinces. Initially, these revolts would be led by Albanian chieftains who remained loyal to Sultan Abdul Hamid, with the most prominent being Isa Bolatini. By the time of the revolution, Isa Bolatini had been around for quite a long time, actually, and as a young man, he had been a member of the League of Prizren, that proto-nationalist government of defense formed amidst the crisis of the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-78, when it seemed quite possible that Albania might be conquered by the invading Russians, and possibly even annexed into one of the newly formed Christian nation states, such as Serbia or Bulgaria. Over the following decades, Bolatini emerged as a powerful chieftain in Kosovo, and his armed bands and protection rackets were a persistent nuisance for local Ottoman administrators. Essentially, Bolatini was like a Balkan-style mafia leader. Then, during the 31 March incident, Bolatini openly offered his guerrilla bands as military support for the reactionaries trying to reinstate Sultan Abdul Hamid. So, once Mahmud Shevket and the CUP had retaken Istanbul, it became clear that the Albanian rebel was an existential threat to CUP power in Kosovo. So, the CUP, together with prominent Albanian landowners who initially supported the Unionists, launched an operation to hunt down Isa Bolatini. This manhunt for the Albanian renegade would eventually morph into a broader effort to crack down on Albanian chieftains in order to bring Kosovo under more centralized control. This campaign would drag on throughout 1909, and the new governor of Kosovo, who was a CUP member, adopted a hard line against his unruly province, imposing martial law, regular taxes, and military conscription. The CUP governor also laid out plans for a provincial census, the imposition of back taxes, and the rooting out of recalcitrant chieftains who had been holed up in their fortress-like houses for decades. As you might expect, these iron-fisted policies had the effect of driving an increasing number of Albanians into the arms of Isa Bolatini. And so, in early 1910, for the first time in nearly 30 years, a large-scale uprising was launched by Albanian chieftains throughout Kosovo. Bolatini convened a meeting of 12 clan leaders, and they agreed to take a besa, or a blood oath, to oppose the CUP's centralization and to demand the return of their rights and privileges enjoyed under Sultan Abdul Hamid. Now, you may remember that one of the most critical moments during the July 1908 revolution was the Firjevik gathering, during which Albanian chieftains in Kosovo took a besa to support the CUP in their demand for a constitution. The defection of the Kosovo chieftains had been one of the primary events that turned the tide in the Balkans decisively in favor of the CUP, and it directly led to the Sultan reinstituting the Mithat Constitution. So, this second besa, in which the chieftains now promised to oppose the CUP, and which was taken less than 2 years after the Firjevik gathering, was a major turning point, and signals the broader breakdown of the Revolutionary Coalition of 1908. The Albanian chieftains would find initial success as they took strategic points and offered stiff resistance to the Ottoman army trying to put down their rebellion. This 1910 revolt was a major crisis of legitimacy for the new government. So Mahmud Shevket decided to leave the imperial capital, as he personally assumed command of the operation in Kosovo and upped the government forces to around 40,000 troops. And apparently, Shevket's chief of staff reported that the commander ordered his troops to raze the fortress homes of the chieftains to the ground, and he even recommended flogging people who were found possessing weapons. So, Shevket planned to completely crush Bolotini and the other rebellious Albanian chieftains. Mahmud Shevket would successfully secure Kosovo, though Isa Bolotini himself evaded capture by fleeing to Montenegro, where he would actually be given weapons by the wily Montenegrin king. Following these rebellions, Mahmud Shevket would implement incredibly harsh measures in Kosovo, with summary executions, the burning of whole villages, and the closure of schools and publications, especially those that promoted the Albanian Latin alphabet or those that were seen as overly nationalistic and therefore threatening to Ottoman unity. The harsh reprisals meted out by Mahmud Shevket and the CUP against Albanians would terribly backfire in almost every way possible. Over the next 2 years, Albanian lands would witness near constant revolt, with a dramatic increase in guerrilla activity and a flourishing of Albanian nationalist organizations. As George Gowrich puts it in his great book on Albanian-Ottoman relations, The Crescent and the Eagle, by the summer of 1911, quote, virtually all segments of Albanian society were involved in the guerrilla activity or secret societies. Doctors, landowners, Bektashi Babas, lawyers, military officers, soldiers, and peasants. These guerrilla bands and nationalist societies would demand administrative autonomy, the union of the Albanian populated provinces into one single province with its own parliament and army, and the appointment of exclusively Albanians to local administration. The Albanians were essentially demanding a status similar to what was offered to the Bulgarians in 1878. And well, the Bulgarians were now an independent and increasingly hostile nation-state. So, the Ottoman government under Mahmud Shevket and the CUP would do everything they could to prevent the granting of autonomy to Albania. But the harsh centralization policies undertaken by the increasingly militarized CUP government in 1909 and 1910 would lead them to become increasingly unpopular and would severely weaken their hold on power. And in Albanian lands specifically, the CUP's recalcitrance would set the stage for Albanian independence by 1912. If you are at all familiar with this story, you know that a whole lot is going to happen before we get to 1912, and Albanian independence would be declared amidst the complete collapse of Ottoman rule in Europe in the wake of the First Balkan War. Because the insurgency in Albania would be simply the first military conflict in what would end up being a near constant state of war in the Ottoman Empire for the next 20 plus years. This series of wars would be catastrophic for the Ottoman Empire and would see the empire through to its final collapse during the Great War of 1914. And so, next week we return to the scheming of the great powers and the Balkan nation-states, which will rear its ugly head once more as an expansionist and irredentist Italy eyes Ottoman Libya. And in September of 1911, as the revolts in Albania were peaking, an opportunist Italy would launch a war of imperial aggression to snatch away the last remaining territories in Ottoman North Africa. But even though the imperialistic Italians believed going into the war that they would trounce the Ottomans and easily take Libya, the Italo-Turkish War would end up being a prolonged war of attrition, with a counterinsurgency that would prophesy anti-imperial modern warfare in the decades to come. This counterinsurgency would be led by none other than Ismail Enver and Mustafa Kemal, both of whom would garner great prestige for their selfless bravery in the conflict, further setting the stage for each of their subsequent rises to political power. So, join me next episode as we travel to Libya 1911 for Enver's War.